Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, the podcast dedicated to M.A.R. Barker's legendary world of Tecumel.
Welcome to episode 4 of the Hall of Blue Illumination. With me today are Victor Raymond.
Hello.
And James Malashevsky.
Hi.
We have received our first email from Kevin Lung. And I asked Kevin if we could read it on the show and talk about it. And he said that would be great. So he says, kudos on the podcast. Hey there. I just wanted to chime in and thank you guys for doing this podcast. I'm very impressed by how knowledgeable and fluent you all are in the world, and it's great to hear so much enthusiasm for it. My father-in-law introduced me to Tecumel about 2 years ago, and I have been running a game for him and several friends in the world ported to D&D 5th edition rules. I have been trying to read as much as possible between Barker's novels and sourcebooks on DriveThruRPG, but I feel like I still don't really get the society and how to really play that out in my game. In your first episode, you talked about fresh off the boat being a good starting point, but I feel like I don't have a sense for what the best resources to continue to learn are, where to immerse myself in this community and world, and how a Tecumel game session goes. Do you have any advice on that? Thanks, Kevin. Well, guys, what do you think?
You want to start, Victor?
Sure. I think for Kevin, the question of I feel like I still don't really get the society is a question that many, if not all, people who play Tecumel end up running into at some point. And my basic piece of advice for this, paradoxically, is don't worry about it. But I don't think that that's going to make an awful lot of sense or be very helpful unless I explain why and what the context is for saying that. My sense on it is that there is so much there. There is so much in the source book, so much in the other materials, the novels, and everything else, that it is easy. In fact, experienced referees and players will get lost in the background detail because they're so enchanted by it. And I think on one level, that's great if you're just, you know, wanting to sort of steep yourself in the background. But for the purposes of running a game, it is almost distracting to have all that detail to try to wade through in order to make the game happen. You know, it certainly was the case that Professor Barker didn't emphasize every single little detail of how Tsolyani society worked or the way that Tecumel operated in every game. In fact, what was interesting was to see how at different times, different sorts of games would just happen within that, you know, background context. And so you can pay a lot of attention to it on the moment when it seems like it's important to pay attention to. And you can also leave some of it behind on the moment because you don't need to have to go through and say, well, yes, you don't really call him a soldier. He's actually a heavy infantryman who's called a Changadesha in Tsolyani. It's like, well, that's great. I mean, but you don't need to go there if you don't want to, is I guess the place to start.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. I have an observation about learning large bodies of information that I think Tecumel is a specific manifestation of. And that is, I do music professionally and have on occasion needed to learn how to do lots of different complicated kinds of things. And there is a point at which you can no longer cram information into your head. But it is being recorded somewhere in you on some level. And it may come out at different times. It's almost as if the conscious mind cannot hold within it all of the details, especially of something like Tecamo. But this notion of steeping oneself in the published materials, just really for the fun of it, because it's enjoyable, ends up having things percolate to the surface. They just come out of one when running a session or playing in a session. Things you may not have thought of for a long time, simply because they've been imprinted on your knowledge base somewhere along the line. I think it would be very difficult to have to line up a bunch of specifics to kind of get right during a session, rather than just more allowing things to come into being. I don't know if I'm communicating what I'm trying to communicate, but it's
That makes sense. Well, what I was going to say, actually, to sort of follow up on what Victor was saying, is that my experience running refereeing EPT campaigns over the last couple of years has been that I actually learn more about the setting from playing it, from actually running it, than I do from reading about it. And as Victor says, you know, you don't need to know all this information. You know, it doesn't come up in the course of play. I mean, much of what transpires in a typical session is something that I think anybody who's familiar with a role-playing game and a fantasy role-playing game probably already knows. It's not so strange or exotic, and you don't need to know all the intricate details of the Tsolyami language, for example, or even the social structure. Sometimes it isn't absolutely necessary, but when certain things will come up in play, and then you're sort of struck at that point, you know, you focus in on them. Those things, as you were saying, you know, they come up. If you've read things beforehand, they just sometimes they'll spring to your mind. And then you just add that little detail. And if for some reason you forget it, I've never found that anyone cares particularly. In fact, sometimes when you forget something and you present it one way, and then later you realize you didn't, you know, include this thing, that can be sort of a springboard for some other idea that'll come up later, you know, that you can sort of expand upon. It's like, well, I didn't. The interactions between these two clans or whatever in the course of that last session wasn't exactly right because I forgot to, you know, make reference to this thing or whatever. So, well, rather than saying it was wrong, it's sort of, well, why wasn't it like that in that case? What was the circumstance that led to that? Is there something peculiar to this particular relationship or the city where it takes place or this part of the empire or just the general circumstances? And it doesn't matter. I mean, I cannot think of any time where I've, after the fact, felt I just didn't know enough and I ruined it. That it was the session was that, you know, I ruined Tecamel. I don't think you can do that.
I don't think that we have the power to ruin.
No, exactly. And I know it's very, very. It's a question, I guess, of how comfortable you become with the setting. And I know in the early days of my involvement in Tecamel fandom, I used to obsess over details, and that seemed very important. But I guess this is all a very roundabout way of saying, when you are actually playing, when it comes to the nitty-gritty of actually running a role-playing game campaign or adventure in Tecamel, it's funny how quickly the things you used to worry about, the things you used to obsess about that you thought were so important, sort of fall away. Not that they're not important, but you just become, or at least, again, it's my experience, I become a lot more comfortable with them, and I just don't obsess over those things. They seem to pale in comparison to all the other things that I like about the setting that, you know, you attach. I mean, everybody has different emphases, I guess, and just play, I guess.
Yeah.
If I can leap in,
please.
I want to provide specific advice on how to approach introducing some of the concepts of Tecamel into a game, and to do it in a way that is not a strain on your memory. And I think it starts off with the basic observation of that a little spice goes an awfully long way. And so, like James said, rather than trying to remember every single little detail and to bring it into the game, it's to think just a little bit ahead of time about what the game might focus on. You know, in much the same way as any referee is going to sit down and do some prior prep about what sorts of encounters there might be. in a game or not, but let's start off with the idea that you're going to do a little bit of prep. Well, then think a little bit about just one thing, just one aspect of what Tecamel is all about, and you can use that as the spice for that game session. So, for example, say the player characters have arrived in a town where they have inadvertently offended someone who is of one of the local noble clans. And it's not something that it warrants, you know, a violent response. It's just they, you know, said something that was perceived as being perhaps, you know, mildly, you know, inappropriate or insulting. Okay, well, the Soliani concept of Shamtla comes into mind, where you could say, ah, well, the noble looks upon you from atop his palanquin and says, you have offended me. You should render now some Shamtla for your insolence and impudence, you know, and to perhaps even have one of the locals who's guiding the party say, well, you know, this fellow here, he's important here, so you might as well, you know, pay him something, you know. And then make that be the moment of the game where you introduce that concept and emphasize to the players it's something they can do as well. They can listen to what people say to them, and if it's something that you know, warrants some sort of response, they could do that. And I'm using that as a completely made up example, but it's one of those things that often comes across to new players of Tecamel. It's like, oh, that's different. I didn't know you could do that. It's like, sure, of course you could. You know. Similarly, the other example that I could think of is, say, in the underworld, it doesn't take a very long time before, speaking of spices, the smell of musty cinnamon and the high chiming of the enemies of mankind.
Run!
Yes. it has its effect, right? And so each game session you can use, if you're going to think about it at all, you can use that as kind of like a, okay, I introduced that thing. And if players remember it later, great. And if not, you can use it again. Or as James said, if something didn't turn out exactly the way you might have intended it to, you can always revisit it and explain why it was it turned out the way it did.
Now, it's funny you mentioned that about thinking in advance of some sort of little bit of spice to include, because I've done similar kinds of things myself. But in another practical way to that I've approached things is, before most sessions that I run, I will always make up a list of names for people whom they might meet and clans, and just very brief information about them, just so that if the characters go off, as they frequently do, on some path that I hadn't anticipated, and they meet someone, I have a ready name for them and who their clan is, and just know a little bit about them, so that it doesn't appear as if I'm, you know, fumbling about to try to, you know, place a context for them. It gives them, it makes them seem like a real person right away, and it helps to put them in the setting a bit more, rather than just, oh, you know, you meet some soldier. He's not just a soldier. Instead, he has a name and a clan and an implied history throughout all that. And sometimes people, the players, will sort of, you know, become fascinated by that and will inquire more, and it leads off into something else. I just find a little bit of preparation, but not anything, you know, greatly in advance that you need to do. I mean, no more than you would do for any other sort of role-playing game, but because I guess Soliani sort of names and sort of family structure and so forth is a little bit different than your typical role-playing game, sometimes it's helpful to have that in advance. But just, you know, it's another simple, practical thing to do beforehand so that it helps to not break the frame and you feel like you're in Tecamel, you're in Soliani, because now you have a person you've met, and he has a name and a clan and a place in the society.
Kagesh, yes. Member exactly. Of the Scarlet Planet of Knives clan.
Yeah, there you go. Clan,
but he's trying to make something of himself.
That's right.
The soldier is a way to do that.
Just so.
Exactly.
So Kevin writes, let me see here. I feel like I still don't really get the society. And that struck me as a pretty juicy statement. And one thing that Victor and I have discussed is that people on Techamel are still people.
Yes.
So even though the trappings of the society are foreign at first, they are still things created by human beings. So the same kinds of plot devices and motivations that she would use in a short story or a screenplay or anything, it still applies because it's human beings that are involved in them. What do you guys think about that?
Oh, definitely. It seems like a really straightforward, simple, obvious thing to say, but I think it deserves to be emphasized because it's easy to get distracted by all of the, the Baroque exoticism of Techamel and the Sulianni society and forget about the fact that, you know, this person that you're interacting with is just a human being. So all the motivations that would typically be expected of people, good and bad, are there. And, once you think about that, it becomes a lot easier to sort of understand exactly. It's like, you know, sure, this guy is the, you know, ritual high priest of the temple of Sarku, the five-headed, you know, god of worms. But he still has motivations that are understandable by other people. He has people whom he loves, people whom he dislikes. He has goals and so forth. And once you get a handle on those, he's not quite so mysterious and frightening anymore. And the other thing too, I think that's
or is he more mysterious?
Or he could be more. He could be more. It's true. But I find, you know, it's one of those things that is really important is to make sure that the people in Techamel that you encounter, the non-player characters and so forth that you interact with, that they really do seem like actual people. It's very easy to get caught up in all the little details, I said. And, you know, what were you going to say, Vic?
Oh, I was going to say, actually, an interesting sort of side comment to what you're talking about. Professor Barker was fond of saying that there are no non-player characters on Techamel.
Yes.
And what he meant by that was that everyone you encounter is just as real as you are.
Yes.
And so if you interact with them, they're going to interact with you on that same basis. And so I think this is a way in which Techamel might be different in some ways from how some fantasy role-playing games are played today, where there's this obvious sense of mooks and bosses and such like. Professor Barker probably wouldn't agree with any of that. His attitude was that each and every person that you encounter was potentially somebody that you should be paying attention to. And so you shouldn't discount anybody. And that can be a little daunting both for players and referees because, you know, if as a player, you might literally have no idea who someone, you know, is this person important? You know, you don't have the little question, or was it, you don't have the little exclamation point over their head saying this person will give you a quest. But the idea here is that with a little bit of thought, remembering that people have ordinary, normal, understandable motivations will carry you a long way to create a real setting for people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So Kevin, he goes on to say, what does he say here? He says he's not sure what the best resources to continue to learn are.
All right, I need to leap in and say, if he's got a set of rules, whether that's Baythorm or Empire of the Petal Throne, he should stop.
That's good advice. Yeah, it really is. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Mic drop. Boop. Good advice.
That's not to say that the other material is not worthwhile. Obviously, from the Foundation perspective, we want people to continue acquiring as much of this background knowledge as we can make it available. But for the purposes of running a game, if you've got a set of rules and you have, I mean, I might go so far as to say if you've read Man of Gold, but I feel even then like I'm that's overdoing. I'd say if you've got a set of rules, stop. Just use what's there. It will be fine. You can add in the other stuff as you go along.
Yeah, it's not like there's a mentality of having, you know, infinite splat books kind of continuing to fill up the conceptual space. It's really, if you have one thing, delve into that. Get the details. Just actually run a game. Have fun. Yes. Make things happen. Instead of this having this kind of consumer point of view where we are trained to have to keep acquiring things before we can do what we want to do. It's just great advice.
I don't want to be sound flippant or anything, but I was going to say, which sort of riffs off what Victor said, is that really the best resource is the game that you're running yourself, your own campaign. That's the primary resource for learning more about tech. I mean, once you've got a rule set, and I would, you know, the source book is probably, you know, the font of all information about TechML. But once you've got those two, find out more about TechML by playing it. You know, if you feel uncomfortable, you feel anxious or concerned that you're going to do it wrong or that it's overwhelming, just start small and fan out from there. And I think people will find it's not nearly as daunting as they imagine it to be. I mean, it's easy to say when, you know, we're sitting around here and we feel comfortable with the setting, but it really is true. It really is true. Just run a game.
The running the game part, though, it also means that you should take some time after a game session is over to reflect on what happened during the game and use that. I mean, be really thoughtful about how to use that in future game sessions to, you know, bring out the world a little bit more, you know, whatever it might be. And I think there's a way in which, like I said, where a little spice can go a long way. It is possible to overdo it. And I think that the thing to do is to gauge that again by how do your players react, what is, you know, their emphasis, and to strike a balance there between having all this information, which you know you could bring in, and what the game itself is calling for. And I think you know, if push comes to shove, you should go with what the game is calling for and not, you know, continuously add yet more and more and more background detail. There's a way in which it will be just a cascade that will overwhelm whatever it is you're trying to do.
However, he said cautiously, it is fun to look stuff up and take notes and craft something out of the research that you do.
Oh, definitely. Sure.
Yes. And in fact, actually, that's something that I made a point of emphasizing in some advice that I've provided online in the OD&D 74 message boards, where all you need to do, particularly with something like Empire of the Petal Throne, is just simply note down the relationships between people as mentioned in the rules, to note down where various different magic items are, to create, just do a little bit of your own sub-creation to flesh out your Techamel, and you will find a wealth of things that will then be, you know, instant fodder for adventures and plot hooks and campaigns.
Yeah, rather than seeing the setting as something that is prescribing a certain way of doing things, it really seems like the setting is designed to be a springboard for your own sub-creations.
Yes, and one of the ways in which Professor Barker writes about the setting encourages this, that you'll find if you go through and you read Empire of the Petal Throne or other materials, that oftentimes he'll have made a statement, you know, someone will ask, you know, are there any riding beasts on Techamel? And the answer that you get is, there are no riding beasts that are known in the five empires. They must have all died off a long time ago, but it is rumored that there might be horses still preserved in some alien you know,
preserve,
you know, somewhere elsewhere on the planet. And there are also the NECA or the Rigelian Bajak that could be found in different places. And, you know, I mean, what's interesting about that is that he gives you sort of this broad answer of, no, they're not available. And then he says, but yes, they are. and that happens a lot in Tekemel of examples of where, yes, generally, you know, this thing is true, except where it's not. You know,
so, like everything has permeable edges.
Yes. And that is it has been one of those things that is a delight to some players and a frustration to others. I don't know how many times over the years Professor Barker would get letters that would ask, or emails that would ask something along the lines of, I want the absolute final answer to question X. And the almost immediate response is, it's not that simple. And that's because, yeah, Tekemel is a vast, intricate, complex world, just like our own. And if you went around asking for what's the, you know, final answer to whether or not we can balance the federal budget, you know, I think the answer that you'd get back from somebody experienced in government is, well, it's not that simple, you know.
So. Right. And I think that was sort of what I was trying to get at earlier, but perhaps not as well as I intended, is that because most aspects of Tekemel have these permeable edges, you have to worry as much about making, you know, mistakes, as I say. You know, if you do something that is contrary to what is in, say, the source book, that's fine, because you can provide, if you want to, if you care about these things, and some people may not care, there's plenty of reasons why, well, yes, it's usually that way, but in this particular case, which is to say the mistake that I'm now canonizing, it's not that way because of these factors or whatever. Because again, any human society is going to have lots of exceptions to things, and the Tsolyani are no different. There's plenty of cases where, well, this is the way things are, except here and here, where they do it this way. And they provide tons of examples. I mean, the source book itself provides plenty of examples of, you know, this is the way Tsolyani culture is, you know, like, for example, I mean, this is one that came up in the Sokatis campaign that I run. As one of the characters preparing to get married, I wanted to find out about what weddings were like in Tsolyanu. Well, the answer is they vary considerably from place to place and clan to clan. And so that gave a great deal of leeway for creating whatever I wanted to create, while still taking into account sort of general kinds of things. And there's lots of that in Tekemel. So, you know, that's these, as you say, I like that phrase, that the permeable edges, you know, that you can, there's lots of scope for individual creativity within the larger framework of Tekemel.
Well, that's, I think that we have addressed Kevin's question.
I hope so.
And I think it boils down to, have fun running your game.
Yes.
Very much so, yes, definitely.
And if that's happening, everything else is secondary.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's exactly right.
Use the source material for inspiration, not as a straitjacket. Oh my goodness, no.
With us today is Jeff D., a veteran of gaming who has many publications and illustrations to his credit. Say hi, Jeff.
Hi, everybody. I'm honored to be here in the Hall of Blue Illumination.
Excellent. So, Jeff, tell us about your relationship to Tekemel, which, as I understand it, goes back pretty far.
It goes back all the way to the original publication of Empire of the Petal Throne. I grew up in a little town about half an hour south of Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and attended an early Gen Con when they were still in the Horticultural Hall in Lake Geneva. This is while I was in grade school. And
this had to have been before Gen Con 10, just to be clear.
I couldn't give you the exact year off the top of my head. But my eldest brother and I both got heavily into the Dungeons and Dragons, and when EPT hit, we picked it up along with everything else that was new at the time. And when he went off to college, he took all of our gaming collection with him, except for the box set of VPT. So that's the game I cut my teeth on as a GM. And, you know, I also showed off my drawings to the guys at the original Dungeon Hobby Shop, which was just the lower floor of a two-story house that was the TSR offices at the time. And my first paid professional artwork ever was in Dragon Magazine number 6. It was some illustrations for the Legions of the Petal Throne miniatures painting guide.
So let's back this up a little bit. Your first, the game that you cut your teeth on GMing was Empire of the Petal Throne.
Yeah.
Oh, that's yeah. Unusual.
Is it?
I think it is. I mean, you meet few people who encountered EPT as their first game. Most people from the 70s, in my experience, go for D&D and then move on to other stuff. But it sounds like everything was kind of popping up simultaneously.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're talking about when, like, Traveler was new, is that kind of era, you know, all the high-profile games in the hobby were just starting to, the old-timey high-profile games in the hobby were just starting to come out. You know, like I said, we owned and played other things, but when I was on my own and having to run for my friends, it was EPT.
What attracted you about the game? The artwork, the weird words, the whole thing?
You know, my appreciation of Tecumel has evolved over time. To be honest, like I said, my brother ran off with everything else. So it was partly, I'm a high school kid now, and it's the only game that I've got. But I loved it because of the huge vistas of possibility that it opened up. You know, you would just look at the maps of the five empires and read the history and you know, read about the culture, what little there was of it in the original rulebook. And it was just an amazing source of inspiration for adventures. And, you know, of course, back in those days, there was so little to go on that I was doing it completely wrong. But
wrong how?
Oh, you know, I mean, the clans are barely mentioned in original EPT. So, you know, wrong in the sense of not really having a grasp of what the world's really like, you know, just going by the details that are available. Like I'm a high school nerd. I put in vampires and stuff because I thought vampires were cool, and all kinds of horrible violations like that. But, now I'm embarrassed myself.
I think that's amazing. I think it's great. You're at an age where there aren't any like learned limitations, or there's no sense of what's right or wrong in a canonical sense. Like the sheer creativity of youth never ceases to amaze me.
Yeah, I want to leap in here and say, doing it wrong. I don't know. You know, Phil was very clear about saying that you could do what you wanted to with your game. And if you put vampires in, and I suspect if you had told him about it, he would have found a way for
well,
that.
I'll tell you, when he introduced the, who are the weird creatures in the underworld, introduced in one of the novels originally that are like insect things, but they look like people.
Oh,
and they travel around little family groups.
Yes,
I've forgotten their name now.
Srumathu.
Yes, Srumathu. When he introduced those, and then dropped a reference that they'd like been with humanity since before they came to Tecumel, I kind of felt vindicated because that's the justification that I had for vampires. Well, of course, the vampires came on the spaceships.
Of course, they were there. Yeah. And as a bit of a note, just for all the audience at home, Dragon number 6 appeared in April of 1977.
There we go.
Which is 2 months before the release of Traveler at Origins that year. So, yeah.
So, yeah. I go way back. And then, over the years, I've tried to keep my hand in. I have a couple of illustrations in the old Tecmel journals.
Yeah.
Or was it Imperial Courier? They might have been one in each. I don't know. I did a little bit of that, and always bought everything that came out. You know, every new system, everything I could get my hands on. But, I fancy myself a game designer, and started publishing my own games back around 2000, and developed my own systems and my own views on how I would like to see things addressed in mechanics. And so I got to the point where I really wanted to play some more Tecmel, and I didn't really want to use any of the published systems, so I started adapting the material that was available for use with my Pocket Universe system. And that was originally just for my use, and we're talking about, 2008, maybe 2009, guessing when this all started happening. And I just kept doing that until I had enough that I could play it. And then I kept doing that until I had enough that I thought, hey, there's no Tecmel games in print right now. It wouldn't take that much more effort to turn this into a publishable thing. And then I contacted the Foundation. Well, I guess I contacted Professor Barker. So the Foundation was just getting started.
Yep. We started the Foundation in 2008. Actually, interestingly enough, shortly we started talking about it, but we got it in place shortly after Gary Gygax passed away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I exchanged one email with Professor Barker about this, and his response was essentially, well, it looks very interesting, but hold off for the moment because we're setting up this Tecmel Foundation thing. So...
So you were using your own rule set to run extended campaigns, or can you tell us a little bit about...
Oh, yes. I'm sorry?
Just want to know more about the kinds of things that you were doing with the rules.
So I ran this this really long campaign set in the east, the little valley heading out to the east of the Empire. What is the name of the city? Now I don't have my things in front of me. But the players were a group of people from a kind of medium-low status clan, and their first few adventures were, well, we're troubleshooters that could be hired by other clans to go into places and, like, you know, clean them out and get them ready for habitation.
Were you teaching your players about Tecmel while you were playing it, or did you come into it with people who were already kind of in the know as friends of yours?
Some of my players were familiar and others not so much. I bet at one point during this talk we're going to get into the fresh off the boat startup, which I have some opinions about. But obviously we weren't doing that in my campaign.
Yeah.
For the moment, I'll just say it took me many years to feel comfortable enough with Tecmel to run an extended campaign. And once I did, I felt that it had partly been difficult because of just the reputation that it's got for being hard to grasp. And my approach has ever since then has just tossed them in. Give them enough basic information so they won't make any huge mistakes, and let it go, and they'll pick it up as they go. And that's what I did. This entire campaign ultimately wound up revolving around a particular player character who couldn't decide what they wanted to take for all of their disadvantages, and then just said, "Surprise me." So I surprised him. And he turned out to be a conglomerate entity made from a body that had been repaired but didn't have any of the other four parts of the self, and the other parts had been harvested from various dead people to build him. But the body was actually cloned from the missing Prince Ridobu. And he was a priest of Xarul and went around with his mask and was fine until he got seen without his mask on by enough random individuals that a rumor got back to Avanthar that Prince Mnidobu had been seen, and then the OAL started coming after them.
That's cool that she would use something philosophical from the setting as a plot device.
I love that stuff. When I'm selling Baythorm at conventions and selling the Tekemel setting to people, what I always say is, because I think this is easier to grasp, I always like to say Tekemel is a fantasy RPG that's built on top of a science fiction premise. So it's a fantasy RPG which offers a wonderful opportunity to explore science fiction tropes through fantasy. And that's kind of, that's what I was doing. You know, we were doing a weird genetic engineering cloning thing.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
I would agree with that completely. In fact, in particular, one of the things that I've encouraged people to do to understand the alien races in Empire of the Petal Throne and Tekemel is to treat them as aliens. Don't think of them as being, you know, oh, Patroi are like elves. That's actually the wrong way to think about it. Think of them as being truly alien races, and then think about how that makes them different from humans.
Right, yeah.
They are alien aliens, too. It's not just some cookie cutter thing that you can step into.
Oh no!
That player, by the way, who was the clone of Prince Mnidobu, that was Dennis Lube, the artist who has done a lot of work for Steve Jackson Games over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. And my goodness, he was the most forthright priest of Xarul you could ever hope to meet. They would meet an NPC and he would want to negotiate with them by spilling all of their beans, which was hilarious.
So you were prompted to write Baythorm because there was not a rule set out there that you wanted to use that was in print.
Yeah, I got picky, you know, so what can I say? And also, you know, my pitch to the Foundation, once the negotiations gotten to the point where we were talking, was my company, Unigames, does not have store distribution. All of our sales are PDFs through RPG Now and print on demand through Lulu. And as a result, it is almost impossible for Baythorm to go away, to go out of print, because even if my partner and I were to die in a horrific car crash, those games could still be bought.
Well, with new distribution models, it's kind of like they're not even really in print. It's this distinction between out of print and imprint has become very fuzzy.
Oh, don't get me started.
Okay, I won't. That is not the subject of this podcast.
the Tekemel has had this terrible curse that no Tekemel game seems to be able to stay in print. And, you know, but part of my selling point, apart from, hey, I think I can make a decent game, is I think I can make a decent game that will stay around.
Well, and actually that was very much one of the things that we had noticed at the Foundation, was that different people at different times had adapted Tekemel or adapted their game systems to the world of Tekemel. And we thought that this was perfectly right and appropriate and appropriate in the way it should be. And so when Jeff came along with his game, which we looked at and said, this looks really cool, we thought, yes, you know, this is a good way to make this move ahead. And best of all, with Jeff's prior track record with games, we were pretty sure that he could do it, which was something that was important to us.
Well, it seems to be definitely a success in that regard. I've read it, but I have not played it. I look forward to playing it wherever, at a con or online.
Cool.
Doesn't really matter.
I had a chance a couple of years ago to play in a, maybe this was longer ago than that, in a playtest, nearly complete version of Baythorn with Jeff and Manda. And that was great. That was at North Texas RPG Con. And I had a great time. And it's interesting to see how each person brings their own sense of Techamel to the table when they're running it. And I think this is wonderful. It allows people to make it their own world. And Manda had clearly done that with the scenario that she was running. And I was entranced. I thought it was great. So, and I say that as somebody who, you know, having played with Professor Barker, of course, the question is, how close was it? And it's like, it was as close as it needed to be, you know? And just in the same way that if Craig Smith or any of the, you know, original players of Empire of the Petal Throne ran their Techamel, they brought their own sense of it to it. And so, you know, play Techamel the way it makes sense to you, and that's the way it should be.
Well, it doesn't really make sense to compare any kind of experience directly with some other thing. I mean, it's good to evaluate things on their own merits.
Well, and that's exactly it. I mean, one of the things that I like about Baythorn is that it actually gets at some of the things that were not addressed in previous editions of the game. Jeff, you probably have a better sense of this than I do, but I remember thinking, oh, yeah, that's right. No one's ever really done that before.
Well, I mentioned earlier that, you know, my approach to running a game is different from the traditional fresh off the boat scenario, in that what I want the players to have is a grounding in just the things that affect them the most at the beginning. And if you read through the Baythorn rules, it's all about not just your stats and your skills and your equipment, but also where your place in society is and how you got to be the kind of person that you are, and what are your connections at the start. And from there, you know, I'm not concerned that players know at the beginning that the Tsolyani don't go much in for chairs, right? That they like cushions. That's not gonna violate what's important about the adventure action story part of the game. So I focus on those things and figure that the players can pick the rest of the stuff up as they go.
Yeah, you can definitely show a lot of things in game rather than having to tell at the beginning.
Right. And I want to, you know, agree with Victor. And any, this is important, you know, I've already revealed my hand by saying that, you know, I preferred my own set of rules over the existing ones. But any discussion of role-playing game design has to be prefaced by the understanding that different game systems suit different styles of play. And every single one is valid for the people who are looking for the kind of play style that it provides.
Yeah, that's the real rule zero right there.
Right. So nothing against any previous or future Techamel RPGs. This is the one that does the things that I want it to do.
Well, there are a lot to choose from.
There certainly are, and that can only be a good thing.
That's been the thing about it that's happened all the way along, is that when Empire of the Petal Throne was first released, the only example that people had to go on was Dungeons & Dragons. But after that time, there were other games that came along. Professor Barker wrote first Swords and Glory and then Gardasial, along with Neil Cawley. And these games were, in their own way, responses to what people said they wanted at the time. And not too surprisingly, what they wanted then isn't necessarily what people want now. So that's okay. And I should also note that, I mean, I've heard of people doing things like adapting RuneQuest rules to Tekkimel. That's been out there for a long time. And there are other adaptations as well. But the thing about it is that that's why a game like Baithorm is important, because it is addressing what people want to see recently, and in its own way provides a window onto Tekkimel that we haven't had before. And I think that's great.
That makes a lot of sense. So, Jeff, you have done a really good job of supporting your game with scenarios and additional materials.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's one thing that...
Well, that's, you know, that's part of the commitment. You know, I wasn't going to do it, loving Tekkimel as I do. I wasn't going to get into it if I couldn't do a good job and, you know, not only keep it in print, but also support it and make it be a viable platform for people to play long term. And that, you know, to do that, you gotta come up with more stuff.
Are you getting reports of other people's campaigns and things that are happening?
Sure. There's a couple or three campaigns that people have posted about on our website, baithorm.com, in the forums. That's always great to see. You know, as a role-playing game designer, I'm not in it to make a thing that's gonna be collected and gather dust on somebody's shelf. You know, to me, the payoff for having done it is hearing that other people have played it and had a good time. And yeah, that's great.
So do you intend to keep supporting your game with more stuff? I mean, what's the future for Baithorm and you?
Well, the latest thing that we've done is we did a Kickstarter project for the Curt Hills Atlas. We had this whole long negotiation with the Tekkimel Foundation because we wanted to have a campaign setting. One of the things I noticed as a Tekkimel player, and when I got into this, is you can actually find a lot of Tekkimel adventures on the internet for free. People have posted things, you know, 20 or more different adventures. But there's a couple of problems with them. One is they're scattered all over the world of Tekkimel. And so very few of those 20 are going to be of immediate value to a campaign you're running unless you're willing to do a lot of editing on them. And the second thing is they're all very specifically focused on characters in a certain position in the culture, right? This, like, this adventure is for a military unit of this legion. You know, that's not going to be terribly adaptable. So we figured we need a chunk of land that we can develop in detail and that we can fill full of adventures that people can then run campaigns in that area, and we'll support them with adventures that take place in that region. And on top of that, if you've looked at our adventures, they all begin with a little discussion of what is the entry point to this adventure. If your campaign is about being from a particular clan, or if your campaign is about being priests of a particular temple, or if your campaign is about being soldiers in a particular legion, right? Or if you're just a ragtag band of weirdos, you know, stuff like that. So
that's what I would ragtag band of weirdos. That's my instinctual pull right there.
That's, you know, that's the D&D-ish kind of approach to it, and that's perfectly valid. And, you know, if you're going to do that, I think your campaign is ultimately going to be about, whoops, it turns out that you guys are this era's, what are they called? The big heroes that come and save the world.
Oh, the hero of the age.
Right. You guys are the heroes of the age. You may not have realized that when you first started out, but the reason you're a weird ragtag band of weirdos that don't really fit together socially is the gods put you together. Ha ha ha. So anyway, we cover all of that in our adventures, and that's, you know, that's our approach. Our adventures happen in a particular area, so they're going to be usable if you're playing in our backyard. And they're engineered, the adventures are engineered, so they're widely usable across a broad range of different types of campaigns. So we had this big negotiation with Victor, and what is the name of that city, that's this little city that's in the valley heading east from the Empire? Can somebody help
me out
with
this?
I'm pulling my book out now.
The Valley.
Because that's a region that I developed a lot for my first Vaithorm campaign, and it's Hekelu.
Hekelu.
Right. But in fact, that was a problem because really the reason why I ran there is there's a bunch of unofficial stuff by somebody else that was on the internet about Hekelu and that region, and I swiped a bunch of it. So then I thought, no, we shouldn't ask for that. And then there's a region way over on the other side of the empire in Panchaka near the Temple of Himukla, where in another campaign, the players had gotten control of a fief, and I put it way the hell out there in this patch of jungle and did a lot of work on the map there. And that was what I originally pitched to the Foundation. Hey, let us take a chunk of map and do that. And Victor, your response was, no, the Temple of Vimukla is really kind of important. We can't let you have that.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is indeed the case.
And then did we pitch the Kurt Hills, or did you do that? I think you did.
I may have pitched the Kurt Hills, but I will say that what we wanted was for an area to be settled on that we could look at and say there isn't that much that has been done there that's in our records, that's in previous campaigns, and that could be used by someone new, and we wouldn't have to worry about continuity problems or having to retcon anything. And that, you know, the Kurt Hills area has been profiled a little bit, but not as much as people might otherwise think. So I think that was the reason why we chose it.
And that was a darn good move on your part, Victor, in retrospect, because even given that that goal, there is a lot that's going on everywhere in the Empire if you look hard enough in the source material. So it has been wonderfully engaging to go and reread everything that we've got to try to find every little reference. And we still screwed up. We missed a lake that was supposed to be in the city of Kathalal. I can't believe we did that.
I missed it. You missed it, man.
It's there now.
Yes.
We've updated the art. And I apologize to people who bought the city of Kathalal map early on because it's missing a lake. They must have drained it temporarily or something. So anyway, our latest, you asked what was up with Baythorm. Our latest thing was the Kurt Hills Atlas project. It consisted of two main things. One is a giant map of that region down to the same scale as Professor Barker's Northwest Frontier Gazetteer maps, if you've seen those.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a hexagon that's about 80 miles across, that's not a very convenient scale for day-to-day adventuring. And, you know, I'm into this for the RPGing. So, and we wanted to match the exact approach taken in the Northwest Frontier maps, because we want our stuff to integrate with all of the source material that has come out since forever. And so we use the same hex grid, the same numbering system as original EPT for the big hexes, and the same format as the Northwest Frontier maps. If you look at it, you could bridge the gap between our Kurt Hills maps and the Northwest Frontier maps by individual sheets of map that are of the same size as Barker's from the Northwest Frontier Gazetteer. And I would like to see at some point in the future a lot more of the Empire mapped down to that level. Mm-hmm. So people can just set off in a direction and have it all covered. So there was the map, though ours is in color and it's one giant sheet because it's just more convenient and pretty that way. And
is the map printed on demand by whomever in a like
yes,
some
we're using DeviantArt for that, which was okay. The cheapest source of poster size prints on demand, and actually comes as like a photo print, so it's glossy and beautiful.
That's and great.
Everybody should buy one if they don't have one already.
Well, I don't know. Sold.
So yeah, that was my focus. I did all the little towns and villages and forts and a few things we did that aren't in Barker's Northwest Frontier maps, because I think they're important for adventuring, is we put in local roads that weren't there on his. You can kind of figure out where they must be from the placement of his villages. We also named all of our towns and villages where he, for the village level things, he only put just a marker that it was there.
By what method did you name them?
There is a wonderful random Solyani word generator webpage thing that I used. And of course, 90% of what it generates is going to be utterly useless. So I would just generate names until I got something that looked good and didn't seem too much like something that we'd done before. Though I think we do have two villages that have the same name in different places on the map, which is fine.
Give me a good reason for that.
We also used, I also used that for, you know, if we had to name a fortress and it was going to be named after a guy or some Solyani word involved, we did that. And then there's also, you know, for like the Fortress of Congelation was actually, I used another app, which is random. It was like kind of like if you're a writer and you need random ideas, there's these random idea generators.
Yeah, yeah.
And this thing came up with the idea of it's cold. So then I went to the thesaurus and I barkerized the name by finding, you know, a more obscure word for cold.
Is that a new neologism or is today the... The unveiling.
A Barkerism? I don't know. I don't even know how accurate it is. I don't know how he came up with his stuff or what his thinking was. But we did want our map to feel like Tecumel. And even though I'm talking about all this random generation, that's because we had a huge territory to fill and name. And, you know, it's random generation with a hefty dose of massaging to make sure that it wasn't stupid.
Yeah, of course.
And we're very happy with the results. So the map part is finished and done and shipped. The book part, though, is the document that is going to give you information on all of these places, even down to the level of the little villages. It is hugely massive, more massive than we expected, more massive than I expected, let's put it that way. My partner, Tal Jamir, is doing the writing on that. She is absolutely brilliant at that kind of material. The first game we ever published together is called Quicksilver. It's a more traditional fantasy RPG. And she wrote all of the town and city descriptions. And it's a map on a much smaller scale than the Kurt Hills region. But I've been able to run 8 or 9 different campaigns over the decades in that area just off of her 1 to 3 paragraph descriptions of each of these places. There's just that much, it's that meaty in terms of ideas. So she's doing that, and it's taking a long time. We just submitted the first, what she says is the first half of the writing, which doesn't cover quite half of the map, but it covers the southern half, which is the most heavily populated. When the foundation signs off on that, we'll just go ahead and make that first chunk of material available to all the backers that were supposed to get the book as a electronic copy of just that text, so they can get started. Because, like I said, we're in this to get people actually playing.
Yeah. So on the topic of getting people actually playing,
yeah.
everything that one needs to find is at Baythorm.com.
It certainly is, and not just our stuff. You know, we're supportive of the entire Tecumel hobby, and so we've made a point of putting in links to the foundation stuff on RPG Now, and James. Fanzine that he puts out, there's a link to that. So we try to be a one-stop shop. If you want Tecumel stuff, you can find where it is by going to Baythorm.com. Oh, also the miniatures from the Tecumel project, there's a link to that on there.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we know of.
That's great. Well, thanks a lot for coming to the Hall of Blue Illumination and telling us about Baythorm. It sounds like it's going places, and that's pretty exciting.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Hall of Blue Illumination. You can email us your questions, queries, and other topics at citizen@techmlpodcast.com. You can also find Tecumel Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, take care and have fun playing in the world of Tecumel.